Lori Ehrlich is with us. She is a state representative serving parts of Lynn, Swampscott, Marblehead, 8th District here in Massachusetts. And Lori, welcome back to MSO News Sports.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be here again.
Well, we have so much to talk about here, and a topic that is receiving a lot of national attention would be terror and also guns. And so you've been working on this issue in the state for a while now. So give us an update on the terror gap bill that you're working on.
Yeah, there's almost nobody who doesn't know about this issue at this point, and largely that knowledge is driven by, unfortunately, terrible, horrific incidents that are happening in the United States, like Orlando. This bill that I filed actually before San Bernardino is now experiencing a second round of attention. And what the bill does is it just adds two disqualifiers to somebody's ability to obtain a firearms license in Massachusetts. And those two things are if you're on the terror watch list or you're on the no-fly list, you will not be allowed to buy a gun in Massachusetts, buy weaponry in Massachusetts. So seems like a simple thing to pass. Seems almost, I've heard it from everything from a no-brainer to people just cannot believe that we're handing weapons to people who are suspected terrorists, but we are. So on the national level, this is something that is actually being voted on today.
Yeah.
There are four items up for vote before the U.S. Senate. Everybody I've spoken to says it's probably not going to pass. That's Congress for you.
Yeah.
You know, I can't fault my reps or my rep or my two senators. They're on board with this, well on board with it, and actually speaking out quite forcefully. But if the federal government can't protect us, I think it falls upon the states to make sure that we take matters into our own hands. So I have filed this bill. Just yesterday on television, the Speaker of the House, Speaker Robert DeLeo, mentioned that he is in favor of the bill, specifically mentioning my bill. And I look forward to seeing it through. It's just it's a matter of public safety. And, you know, I agree that it is truly a no-brainer.
It is, I guess. And I think nationally, have you looked at how that bill, your bill, would have, say, impacted Orlando, that kind of situation?
Well, it's interesting that the guy in Orlando was on the terror watch list at one point, and after they investigated him a little further, they actually removed him. So I don't know that it would have necessarily had a direct impact on this incident, but perhaps Congress will be successful, or the Senate will be successful in requiring also people who are no longer on the terrorist watch list still be watched, and just for a matter of safety.
You know, I heard some of the discussions on some of the Sunday shows, and it seems to me that, like in that case you mentioned, if he's off the watch list, then he's good to go, kind of, mm-hmm. and that doesn't help out anybody. And it just seems like there's still another piece here. You know what I'm mm-hmm. saying on that terror watch list, because that apparently is either too big, too small, or whatever, or you know, it's not apparently not useful in this case.
Yeah, in this case, it probably wouldn't have made a difference, but still, it's not hard to imagine that it would make a difference in another instance. The terrorist watch list is something that's been in existence for 11 years now, and it's something that I know I wouldn't want to get on an airplane without. From what I understand, there's about 700,000 people on the list, and only about 10,000 are actually U.S. citizens, which I find really interesting. But it's not perfect. You know, in this kind of this is not math necessarily. It's an art form, but it's something that is there to keep us safe, and something that as long as it's there, and these people are too dangerous to fly, these suspected terrorists are too dangerous to fly, I certainly don't want us handing them deadly weapons.
Right. And I think a lot of folks agree with that. I don't know if there's been a poll on that piece, but I think if you were to ask that question in a poll, I would imagine it would have overwhelming support.
Yeah, it does. And it crosses party lines. You've probably heard that Governor Charlie Baker, my constituent, is in favor, as is the Speaker. My colleagues who have supported my bill are bipartisan.
Yeah.
Really, it's pragmatic stuff that just needs to be done.
Now, in regards to this bill, you've made several trips to the White House. So you've been flying to Washington here of late, too. Tell us about those trips.
Yeah, I have. In the last 6 weeks, I've been invited to the White House 3 times. Each trip has a different purpose, but they are all I'm on the White House's radar because of this terror gap bill. And one visit was just ceremonial. I was invited to welcome in the Prime Minister of Canada and his wife. But the other two were related to this bill. One was a 50-state convention of all state legislators who are working on gun violence prevention issues. And I was joined by the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh. Wow. I was joined by the attorney general, Mara Healey, and my colleague, David Linsky. And it was a great trip and really great to meet people in all 50, or it was 48 states actually that showed, to meet them and hear what they're doing in their states. It was powerful. And this last visit last week was just a meeting at the White House with me. And it was just around this bill. So I'm really, I love these invitations. They're not just ceremonial though, they're meaningful. And the White House, it's nice to be engaged with the White House.
Now who did you meet with the last time at the White House?
It was White House staff, and it was just a real nuts and bolts discussion about what's going on in Massachusetts, what my needs are around this bill, and just a sharing of information.
If you were to share one story with the larger group that you met with at the White House from the 48 states, did anyone have a particular story of interest bringing in from their state, or an idea that was different, or a problem that's different than what Massachusetts might be dealing with, or paralleling?
You know, there are different attitudes in different states. But I have to say, out of all the people, we heard a lot of speakers at this convention, and out of all the people I heard, our Attorney General, Mara Healey, had the most powerful presentation, I thought. She interspersed her discussion about what we can do about gun violence with letters from children who had written to her to do something about this issue. And they really hit you. Like, there's something very unvarnished about children and their outlook on things, and just very pure in their way of not understanding why this isn't why we're not doing something about this. So I found her speech particularly powerful. Marty Walsh was tremendous as well, and it was great to hear from other states too.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to share anything more on that piece or. Yeah, that's good. So let me ask you about a bill that you've also been working on gas leaks. Now, this bill has passed the House, correct?
Yes, that's correct. It just passed just recently, since last we spoke. And that bill is in regard to tens of thousands of gas leaks throughout the infrastructure under our feet that's just leaking explosive natural gas into the atmosphere. And as if the explosive part of this wasn't bad enough, we're also paying for all that lost gas. Yeah. And it's a big problem. Harvard did a study, and they determined that lost gas that's passed on to us gas customers amounts to about $90 million per year just in the greater Boston area.
Now, in your bill, what does your bill do to address that issue?
My bill requires that they fix all the leaks in 5 years, and it's as simple and as complicated as that. That it also allows municipalities a certain amount of leeway while their roads are open to require the gas companies to come in and make the repairs, so they're not digging up brand freshly paved roads all the time.
Tell me the story, too, about how you got involved with this issue, okay? Because, again, it seems like it's one of those issues that we're all aware of. I think we talked about this last time, but the scope of it and the magnitude of it is something clearly, again, we're not familiar with.
Yeah. This issue has so many constituencies, and if it gets over the line, it will solve so many problems. And just to give you a list of some of the constituencies, first of all, it's a natural resource that we shouldn't be wasting. It's very expensive. It has climate impacts that are deemed 27 times worse than CO2, which we all know is heating up the planet. It will create jobs to make the repairs. It will also, the municipalities, and this is how it originally got on my radar, municipalities are stepping up because they're very upset about the trees that are dying on their city streets because the gas leaks are not being repaired. So they're very upset about the expense of the trees, the loss of their urban landscape, the characteristics of their city, their downtowns are being lost when these big shade trees come down. So they're upset. It's something also that has an incredible return on investment. The return on investment, if you balance the cost of the gas that we're buying, literally buying from the gas companies, with the cost of making the repairs, the return on investment is in about 1 year. So I thank the speaker for recognizing that this is a great issue, and for bringing it to the House floor, and I'm really proud of my colleagues for passing it.
And I'm guessing here too, I'm always looking for motivation, or not always looking for motivation, but in this case, the gas companies are still getting their money, whatever they need, they're getting their money. And as far as a safety issue is, I'm thinking that, you know, initially you think, wow, this is a safety issue, but apparently it must dissipate in a way that it's not that much of a safety issue as far as fire and explosions, unless you're right next to a pipe that's broken. That's a different story. But is that how it just kind of trickles under our radar screen, more or less?
I think we have to look back to last session. In last session, the legislature passed a gas leak bill that really took care of the leaks that are really close to buildings. So those are known as grade ones. So there's grade one, two, and three. The grade ones are right up near a building, and they fix them anyhow. The gas companies fix them because they don't want to see houses explode and people die. Oh, yeah. It's bad for everybody. So they're very motivated to fix those. The other ones, some of them have been around for 30 years or more, decades. They've known about them, they watch them, but they don't make the repairs because it's almost as if they have a customer in us. They're selling us the gas, so why shut off a customer? And why put a crew on the road to make the repair, you know, and pay for that if you're just selling the gas? So I would say they've been irresponsible for decades, and we're finally holding their feet to the fire. I'm really glad about that.
Yeah, we're talking with Lori Ehrlich, the state rep from serving part of Lynn, Swampscott, and Marblehead. And Lori, let's move to another topic, a bill that you've been working on for a while too, called on non-competes for employment. And for quite a few years now, 8 years, is it? Mm-hmm. 8 years you've been working on this. So you must have started this year, you know, your very first day there. But now for non-competes, I've heard about it in the broadcast industry. You're a television anchor. You're Natalie Jacobson, let's say, years ago at Channel 5. You can't just jump to another station without, you know, with they might have, you know, you have to wait a year, you have to wait 6 months or whatever. But this is big in other businesses too, obviously.
Right. And actually, for broadcast journalists, there's actually a special exemption that non-competes are not enforceable against them, just so you know.
Oh, wait a minute. Explain that again.
Yeah, non-competes are unenforceable against broadcast journalists, just so you know.
Oh, okay.
And that came about, from what I understand, it was before my time and understanding of this issue. Howie Carr, he drove that effort to exempt broadcast journalists. Also exempt are doctors, nurses, and social workers and lawyers. So those are the exemptions in Massachusetts. It varies state to state, but in Massachusetts, if you're any of those categories, you can have a non-compete, but it's not going to be enforceable. And people should know that, because a lot of times people have non-competes and they assume that they're bound by them, but some of them are just way out of bounds. We've seen 3-year non-competes, 5-year non-competes, and to tell somebody that they can't work for that period of time is just onerous.
Well, it's not surprising the lawyers got involved with this piece, right? There's exactly. A little slap at the lawyers here. But give me an example, though, someone, whether it be not an individual that you know per se, but of a business where they might have a typical non-compete. Another example other than the ones you kind of mentioned. What would be an example of that?
Yeah, it traditionally non-competes were, you would see them in the tech industry or where there's a lot of trade secrets. Gotcha. And that's how they started. But now they're popping up in crazy places. The person working at the yogurt shop, the camp counselor, which so many people have heard about. I had a guy who worked for a company that he applied pesticides to lawns, and he was bound by a 3-year non-compete. And what people don't understand, non-competes are not to protect trade secrets. They're not to protect that. They are trade secret law is very strong in Massachusetts, and that is still there to protect those trade secrets. Non-competes just stop you from working for a competitor. And what happens sometimes is people may be highly trained in a certain area. So this one woman, she had a PhD in voice recognition software, and she was a software engineer. And there were limited places where she could work and put her PhD to work. And she found out from her non-compete that she would have to leave the state to work in the field that she was trained in, or take a job that she wasn't trained for. Mm-hmm. So it really, we heard, you know, for the 8 years that I've been working on this, we've had packed hearings where people, totally lopsided, where people have come out and said that I lost my house because of this. My children left the state because they were subject to a non-compete, and I want to bring them back so that they can live close to home. We had a woman who worked in a pizza shop, who testified that she had to come. She not only was out of job, but she had to come up with $50,000 to pay legal fees to fight her non-compete so she could work in another pizza shop. And she was a single mother. I mean, they're just heartbreaking stories. But the one that captures most people's attention is this high school camp counselor. She worked at a day camp in Wellesley. She was subject to a non-compete. The non-compete, even after the summer was over, she couldn't babysit within a certain radius of the camp. I mean, it was just a great example of a ridiculous application for a non-compete.
That sounds that's all like news to me. You know what I mean? This is like all new to me. So the idea here is that these businesses are able to get away with that because in essence it must, you know, keep your, and somehow they think it helps them keep their employees at a certain rate opposed to a more free market for employees. Does that sound right?
That's exactly right. And they also, I've heard it referred to as it suppresses wages. Yeah. So people feel they're stuck. They don't seek a job that where they might get paid more because they feel they're stuck. So it suppresses their wages, but even economy-wide, it has the impact of suppressing wages and also having a dampening effect on innovation. So the people who are part of this incredible startup culture in Massachusetts, we look to Silicon Valley, where, by the way, there are no non-competes. California does not allow for non-competes. And we try to emulate or create in our own way a great startup culture, but non-competes are a huge hindrance to that. Yeah. So I hope to see this over the line. Speaker again is in favor. The Senate has already voted on it in favor. So I think we're heading to a good conclusion on that.
Well, sounds good. Just maybe a couple of other things on the budget. The budget is coming down in conference right now between the House and the Senate, but you were able to secure a few budget items to benefit Lynn Swampscott Beach area.
Yeah, I'm really proud of these two. First, I got $55,000 for the algae issue along Kings Beach. And anybody who lives in that area is very familiar with what I'm talking about. This is an algae that is found in two places on planet Earth, Lynn Beach and a beach in Italy. It's called Pilela algae. And it has a smell. If it's left to bake in the sun, it will smell. And anybody who's lived around here for a while knows that we've had a good stretch of years with that smell. But in past years, it was unlivable over there. So every year, I make sure that DCR, which is the owner of the beach, Department of Conservation Resources, that they keep up with the algae removal. They remove it in the spring. Once it's removed, doesn't smell for the rest of the summer. But you have to catch it at the right time. So that's what that's about. And then the other one is maintenance for Red Rock Park, which is a great gathering place. For all the residents in that area come to summer concerts and people just gather there. It's a beautiful park right on the water. So that's just for maintenance of that park. So I'm really, really pleased to have successfully gotten those through the House, and then I think the Senate conferred.
Exactly. Well, Laura, is there anything else you want to mention to us at all? Any other topics or anything like that to share with us as we talk on this. I guess it's the first day of summer here, right?
Well, happy summer to everybody listening. And I don't know. It's been just such a great session, and I could not be more proud of my district and the people in it. I love my job. I love what I'm doing, and hope to continue doing it for the foreseeable future.
Sounds good. Laurie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay. Laura Ehrlich, the state representative serving a part of Lynn, Swampscott, and Marblehead with us here on MSONewsSports.com.